nobody in a democracy makes difficult decisions when easy decisions are in front of them. It doesn't make sense. You need pressure or like a political cost in order to change your political calculation. And Israel doesn't have that.
Welcome to the 972 podcast. I'm Michael Schaefer Omerman.
And I'm Henriya Chakar. Every episode, we'll be interviewing activists, politicians, and journalists to discuss the issues and stories that other media outlets tend to ignore.
Speaking of things that are missing from the conversation, Israeli elections are rapidly approaching, and we think they're being reported wrong. There's a lot of context that just doesn't make it into the papers. So this week, we're going to bring you two perspectives, two views, one from the Israeli side, one from the Palestinian side, that we think are really important for you to have.
Later in the episode, Omar Rahman, a visiting scholar at the Brookings Institute,
and a former 972 writer,
will talk about how Palestinians who live under Israeli rule but don't have the right to vote understand Israel's, I guess, not-so-democratic system.
But first, we have 972 writer Noam Shezaf. Noam's going to talk about how Israelis keep choosing the occupation. How when we talk about the Israeli electoral system and Israeli politics in general vis-a-vis the Palestinians, we tend to think of it as a binary choice between one or two states, either this or that. But Noam's theory, and I have to say I agree, is that there's a third option, one that Israelis keep choosing. And that's the occupation.
Welcome, Noam.
Hi, Mike. Great being here.
So we keep talking about what these elections are not about. And the general answer to that is the occupation. But I was thinking back to some articles that you wrote a few years ago about how for Israelis, for regular Jewish Israelis, voting for the status quo of military occupation as opposed to a two-state solution, as opposed to a one-state solution, is actually the rational choice to make. Can you explain that?
Yes, and I think this actually goes down to Bibi's appeal and to part of the reason that he was able to stay in power for such a long time, 10 years, 10 consecutive years now. If you look at the occupation and the sort of solutions that are being offered to Israelis, the most obvious one is the two-state solution. And the least popular one or least obvious one is the one-state solution. And usually we treat them as a binary choice. If you don't do the two-state solution, you'll end up with the one-state solution. But I think that in the real framing, and this is where political decisions are made both by the voters and by the leaders, there's a third choice of maintaining things in there as they are. Let's call it the status quo. So let's talk about the Israeli choice. Israelis, when they look at the two-state solution in the style that it was being promoted in the 90s and in the previous decade, when Prime Minister Barak and Olmert negotiated for peace, it meant for Israelis the withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza, obviously, the dismantling of all the settlements that are now in the West Bank, a huge internal battle, significant financial costs, and we must also admit significant military risk because nobody can predict what will happen 5, 10, 15 years from the day the peace sign is agreed or the day that Israel leaves the West Bank.
And that's been the main argument against the two-state solution.
Yeah, and we tend to dismiss these arguments, but they have merit, and history has shown this. And I'm talking from the perspective of Israelis, not from the perspective of justice, of what should be. The one-state solution from an Israeli perspective is even worse, because you're talking about annexation of the West Bank and Gaza, and in theory, full voting rights to all the population between the Jordan River and the sea. And when the populations are almost equal in their size, 6 million each, then at best you will look at a different political system, which will be in a sort of a draw. At worst, from an Israeli perspective, it will be dominated by Palestinians. The political system will be dominated by Palestinian parties, which means that through democratic means, there'll be a complete redistribution of wealth. There could be a complete redistribution of wealth and political resources and of land, a return of refugees, and many things that taps into the fears of Israelis. And that's also a significant cost. Now, the status quo has some costs to it, but the costs are far fewer than the ones I mentioned, whether it's the one-state solution or within the two-state solution. Netanyahu and the right have been saying to Israelis that not only that the status quo is significantly better than the one-state or the two-state solution, that some of the things that people said you can achieve through a peace process of a peace deal can be achieved within the status quo, say new relations with moderate, as they call them, Sunni countries, as Netanyahu has been achieving in recent years.
He's been meeting publicly with leaders of Oman, yeah, and not to mention all the African countries that he's been trying
to. Yeah, and Israel has secret relations, which are more and more public, with Saudi Arabia, of course. And Israel is conducting joint military operations in the Sinai Peninsula with Egypt. So you take all this together and you say, and an Israeli would say, there is an option where I don't pay anything and I'm getting some of the benefits of the peace process. And if you understand that, you realize why the status quo from an Israeli perspective is far superior to the two other options. And obviously it costs less internally. There's no internal struggle over the desired solution. And Israelis have been electing in the past 10 years the person who's the embodiment of the status quo, Netanyahu, who invented himself as a very gifted politician in maintaining things as they are.
So in this election, I would argue that Gantz and the Blue and White Party, the centrists, the generals, that they're actually the ones offering the status quo. And that Netanyahu is offering a much further and rapid drift to the right. And when you talk about a one-state solution as opposed to a two-state solution, really we're talking about two different visions. One, you said, is equality for everybody and one person, one vote. And the other that we talked about, that we often talk about, is an apartheid one-state reality. Is that the natural progression of the status quo if it's preserved?
I think that Israelis are now in a certain consensus around the status quo. So I don't think it's fair to say that Netanyahu is the status quo candidate or that Gantz is the status quo candidate. I think the system as a whole is oriented towards not doing any radical changes in the foreseeable future. And part of it is because they don't sense any pressure to do that. There is not much of an incentive to make those tremendous leaps forward of, you know, disengagement style retreat from the entire West Bank and all that.
So we'll get in a second to what could create that kind of pressure. But let's talk about actually the opposite pressure that we heard about this week, which is Donald Trump saying that he's going to recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which effectively is recognizing the permanency of a status quo, not the whole status quo, but a status quo. How does that change the way that Israelis or the right wing or Bibi look at that calculation?
That's a very good point, because Donald Trump's recognition of Israeli sovereignty in the Golan Heights, which were captured from Syria in 1967, and also the transfer of the American embassy to Jerusalem, which was seen in the Israeli public, was interpreted as a recognition of Israeli annexation of East Jerusalem, are actually a sort of a proof or a good argument to show that the right or the conservatives have been right all along.
Which is that we just have to wait.
Exactly, that Israelis just need to wait enough and an opportunity would emerge to legitimize the facts on the ground that we created. So from a conservative perspective, there's a sort of redemption, a sense of redemption for the whole ideology right now. We used to say that conservatives don't have any solution, don't have any ideology. But they now will say, we do have a solution. And the solution is to keep things as they are and to wait and see, and to see whether changes on the ground, changes in the international system, regional change, and will give us more and more opportunities to get to legitimize those acts that we're taking now and are considered by some illegitimate. Israel has been able in the last 2 years, because of Trump, to reach significant unilateral achievement, at least in the sphere of legitimacy. Whether it can be reversed or not, that's a good question.
Not only with Trump. I mean, Netanyahu's relationships with Poland and Hungary have gone a long way in effectively neutering the EU's ability to do anything. A few years ago, it seemed like there was maybe some opportunity for the EU to put real pressure on Israel. And
so that's another argument for Bibi. Bibi has been very skillful in using the internal structure of the European Union and of the United States, one should add, that they were, the United States and the European Union might have been the two main stakeholders that were pushing for a negotiated resolution. And Netanyahu was able to nullify that during Obama's term through the use of Congress and in the EU through the use of some countries who will not allow the European Union to pressure Israel. And the European Union is a consensus-based body in terms of foreign policy. So, but I'm not sure that Netanyahu can push the European Union as far as the active policy of legitimizing those Israeli annexation acts as the United States did. All Netanyahu was able to do was to nullify certain more coercive policies that the European Union was considered. And we haven't seen anything from the European Union since the guidelines regarding joint projects, which I think were 2012 or something. So that's a long time from now.
Those guidelines were spoken about in Israel and especially by the government as a potential game changer. People were talking about differentiation between the settlements and Israel as a boycott of the settlements and a boycott of the settlements as a boycott of Israel. And it was spoken about in serious terms, perhaps something that could have created some pressure. What would it take to change that calculation where Israelis, where the safest choice, where the most rational choice is to choose the status quo?
I'm not sure. If I had a silver bullet, I would have, you know, we would have used it as sort of a mechanism that will make everyone see what an agreed upon just solution is the right way to go. I think that it's clear that Palestinians could use various tools to, I'm not talking about violence, I'm talking about various political tools that they have to create certain pressure on Israel. But the Palestinian people are so fragmented and the political system there is in such a crisis that explains a lot of the achievement made by Israel. It simply has no adversary now. On the international front, I think that an international effort, a coordinated international effort, could have convinced Israelis to move in a different direction. But even a diplomatic one, you don't have to go all the way to boycotts and stuff, but I don't see an international consensus around anything, let alone the Palestinian issue. Having said all that, the issue is not going away, because the Palestinian issue and the conflict are rooted in the facts on the ground. So I don't think the problem is just because we dismantle the tools that were used to address this problem. I don't think the problem is going away.
Right. You mentioned that there's a lot of things Palestinians could do to put pressure on Israel, to change the calculations of regular Israelis, mm-hmm. of Israeli leaders. In the past decade or so, we saw the rise of something that a lot of people called a rights-based discourse, to start presenting and thinking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict not as necessarily a political conflict between two nations, between two political entities, but as a struggle for equality, for civil rights, for human rights, of everybody living under some form of Israeli control between the river and the sea, in whatever political solution that might look like. It seems that in the Trump era, as we've seen the rise of right-wing nationalism in the world, that's regressed a little bit, that it seems a little bit less of a relevant direction to try and push. Do you think that's true? And do you think there's a way to reverse that? Or is that even a good idea?
I'm not sure I agree with the way you put things. If you look at the Trump era, I'm not sure that the right based discourse has disappeared. You should simply look, for example, at the Me Too movement and the way it revolutionized the discourse after Trump got elected. Now, the rights-based discourse is an appealing idea, especially for Western ears, and there are other tools that the Palestinians could have used, political tools. I think I want to be careful here because there's something awkward and weird as an Israeli to be judgmental of Palestinian politics in the context of the occupation, in the context of the conflict. So I don't want to be in a position that I give advice to Palestinians how to run their own politics. But I think the problem is that from where I sit, that everyone in the Palestinian field, you know, pursue its own politics. And you got armed wings, you got political parties, you got a split political system, you got activists looking for the rights-based solution. And in some scenario, these efforts might complete each other, but right now they seem more at odds with each other than completing each other. And I think Israel has been very skilled in using those tensions and those contradictions within the Palestinian struggle to divide and conquer, if you want, and direct the general sense of things in its favor, in Israel's favor.
Just this last week, Bibi basically bragged about how transferring or allowing the transfer of money to Hamas was part of his strategy of dividing and conquering the Palestinians.
Right. You know, I remember I published, I think it was 7 years ago, we managed to get a slideshow of the Israeli army saying that the separation between the Gaza Strip and the West Bank is a policy of the army. And we were very proud that we were able to post it because that was a violation of the Oslo agreement that treats Gaza and the West Bank as one territorial unit. So now you don't need to have secret documents in order to see, because you get a prime minister saying that the division between Gaza and the West Bank is an Israeli interest, and you get the heads of the military saying that. So I think, again, Israel has been very, and Netanyahu specifically, has been very successful in using all those sorts of opportunities that emerge along the way, and changes on the ground and real splits in the Palestinian camp for his advantage and for the advantage of prolonging the occupation and prolonging the status quo. And I think if we were 10 or 15 years ago, even in the height of the Intifada, if you would ask Israeli how long the occupation would last, it would say it could last for 5, 10, 15 years more. And now, if you ask most of Israelis, they will tell you, I don't see an end in sight. You know, anything might happen tomorrow, but I don't see an end in sight. And that's a fundamental change that Netanyahu was able to introduce in Israel, in the Israeli psyche. We see the status quo now as a viable option. I think one of the things that we need to learn as lefties living here is a way not to wait for other forces to change the status quo, but to find ways to address the Israeli public and with a viable and compelling alternative that will, given the right opportunity, can be turned into a new reality.
Thanks for coming on the podcast, Noam.
Thanks for having me.
Next up, former 972 writer Omar Rahman, a journalist and visiting fellow at the Brookings Institute in Doha, where he's writing a book about Palestinian relations across the Green Line.
Welcome, Omar.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to be back in the 972 orbit at long last.
When we talk about Palestinians in relation to Israeli elections, we usually talk about Israeli candidates' position toward the conflict, toward the two-state solution. But what is the Palestinian relationship to the Israeli democratic system, to the Israeli elections?
Well, Palestinian relationship to Israeli democracy in general and to Israeli elections, I think, specifically, is pretty deeply complicated. I think at the kind of explicit level, we look towards democracy like anywhere else, with the kind of implication or the promise of change. So Palestinians look at Israeli democracy with the hope or expectation that it might produce a different leadership that's more amenable to peace, I think, on Palestinian terms, or towards ending the 51-year occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So that really hasn't worked out or hasn't panned out very well for the Palestinians. And that's kind of produced a really deep cynicism and just kind of a dismissal of the possibility for Israeli elections to produce a leadership that might end the occupation. And I think that's especially true today. And we can kind of get into the discrepancy between Benny Gantz and Benjamin Netanyahu. But, for the time being, there's a feeling that Palestinian freedom and political rights are kind of hostage to the whims of Israeli society, and they don't really produce anything. I think more interesting on the kind of implicit level is the fact that Palestinians are more or less governed directly and indirectly by Israeli elected politicians. They don't really have any say in electing. And obviously, this is a little bit different for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and we can get into that. But Palestinians in the occupied territories don't have any say. And this kind of speaks to the apartheid-style system that's in place and has been established between the river and the sea, or what some Israeli scholars or other scholars call kind of the one-state condition. And so in Gaza, for example, this has implications on the severity of the siege that's been imposed on them, on the freedom of movement, or the movement of goods and services in and out, to the level of, Israelis controlling what they say is like the caloric value of every, the average Gazan citizen. And also the structural use of violence against Gazans. And this is something we see today with the Great March of Return. So a Gazan doesn't have the right to protest civilly within their own territory without the threat of lethal violence from the Israeli military. And so people have lost their lives and lives destroyed over that. And so you can see that kind of level of control. When it comes to the West Bank, that control is much more pervasive, and it speaks to kind of the difference in the system. And so Israeli policies towards the development of settlements, towards the development of settlement infrastructure, towards land confiscation, freedom of movement, which affects the Palestinian economy, education, healthcare, the collection of taxes, which goes to the salaries of civil employees of the Palestinian Authority, water policies, the appointment of judges in this kind of military system, and the civil administration, every aspect of life is controlled to an extent by Israeli elected politicians that the Palestinians don't have control over. And so, yes, there's the existence of the Palestinian Authority, which is a kind of – it governs the lives of Palestinians in areas A and B to an extent, which is about 40% of the territory, but the vast majority of Palestinians. But it's the real sovereignty is vested in the Israeli government, not the Palestinian Authority. So
Under the laws of occupation, they are the acting sovereign.
Exactly. So the Israeli military or security services can enter into Area A, into Ramallah, the seat of the Palestinian Authority, and arrest somebody and whisk them away and put them under military trial. Okay, and so we can see that Palestinians don't really have control. Sovereignty rests with Israel. And so when we step back for the average Palestinian, when we're looking at Israeli elections, whether it's the left or the center or the far right that's elected, that has a tremendous impact on the daily lives of Palestinians, and they don't have any say over that. And so there's a deep uneasiness over what's coming, which you have no control over.
What's the feeling of watching another people have democratic elections miles away that is affecting your life, and yet you have no say in it? I mean, you could put it on a range anywhere from a military dictatorship to some sort of apartheid to I don't know what. I mean, what does that mean for the way that people look at the powers that govern them?
Yeah, I mean, again, like I kind of alluded to before, it produces a deep uneasiness. Again, you don't have a control over your life. And I think Israel and its military and the way it runs the occupation, it does this on purpose, is it doesn't give any sense of regularity to daily life. It disrupts things on purpose. It moves checkpoints. It has, the strictness of checkpoints alter all the time. The presence of the military, you see them sometimes and they disappear. It's to kind of give the sense of lack of control, and therefore people kind of govern their behavior. They can't adapt to the system or the rules as they understand them. And the rules are kind of constantly changing. And, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, I've read quite a bit about the legal system of the Israeli occupation. You know, there's just a kind of a confluence of different laws and regulations that the Israelis use at their discretion. And, you know, it's very hard to kind of understand that. So I think people feel unmoored. They don't feel any control over their lives. And most importantly, I mean, when we look at Gaza as well, the ability to counteract the occupation or to resist the occupation in any way, no matter what you do as a Palestinian, whether it's civil protest, whether it's armed resistance, whether it's negotiations, any direction you take, whether it's at the UN, produces no results. And therefore, that feeling of a lack of control really kind of dominates life.
It sounds like a lack of personal or national self-determination.
That's right.
And what about the candidates themselves? We have Benjamin Netanyahu, and in some ways we know who he is. We know the policies and the views that he has, even though he sort of speaks in doublespeak a lot of times about his positions specifically toward the Palestinians. And on the other hand, the main challenger, the only real challenger here, it's not clear that he's offering anything different. How do Palestinians, or how should Palestinians, view the Israeli elections as it relates to them?
Well, let me start with how they do. And, you know, this varies to how deeply people are thinking about it. But as I said, there's a kind of a cynicism and a dismissal of Israeli elections. So people generally don't give it that much thought. They might lump the two together and say there's really no difference for us in them in terms of where we're getting. Although, you know, I got into the kind of implicit level on daily control. You know, Netanyahu is a known quantity. And, you know, if Palestinians see, and they do, and I was having conversations even yesterday with people that said, you know, they're all terrible, but Netanyahu is the worst of the bunch, right? And so he's a known quantity. He's been around for a very long time. Everybody knows him. Palestinians in general blame Netanyahu for undermining the peace process to an extent. And so he's looked at pretty poorly. Gantz is not well known, but he, you know, as he touts, comes out of the military. And unlike the Israeli society, which views the military as this kind of with esteem towards this institution, you know, the Palestinians, you know, to say the least, have never had anything good come out of the Israeli military. And so they look at Gantz very skeptically at the start, although his policies are not well known, although, you know, he's running for election. It's democracy. He's campaigning. And in his campaign platform, for those that are paying attention, you know, it doesn't look very good. He's touting like what he did in Gaza and all this kind of stuff. And so it doesn't look good for his point of view. And when you look at it more deeply, I kind of tend to see two different camps that really have not emerged recently in Israel. They've always been there, but are really kind of at the height of their power, at least, and are the kind of central tension in Israeli politics today, and that's between this kind of pragmatic, security-focused group of politicians and security establishment. I think Gantz and Yalon and Ashkenazi and all these guys represent that on one side, and those guys want to see stability in the West Bank. They would, I think, like to preserve the status quo, preserve the Palestinian Authority, which kind of serves Israeli interest in keeping everything stable, kind of preserve that system. Whereas the Israeli right, and Netanyahu falls in a weird place in this, but he represents a coalition of ideologues to some extent, I think, want to see the dissolution of Palestinian nationalism altogether, its institutions, and that includes the Palestinian Authority. You know, they obviously don't want to control the lives directly of 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank and 2 million in the Gaza Strip, but, you know, if they can create some kind of autonomous authority or dissolution and decentralization of the Palestinian Authority into like regional camps, you know, your mayor of Nablus and Jenin and Ramallah and Hebron or Khalil, I think that's kind of preferable to them because they want Israel to be the only sovereign entity in this territory. And the Palestinian Authority smells too much, even though it's not sovereign, smells too much like a sovereign entity.
Well, it was designed on the way to something to serve as an interim.
The Palestinians thought that, I think, you know, the Israelis designed look a little bit differently. I mean, there was never any explicit mention of a Palestinian state until much, much later. And I think, you know, the Oslo Accords reflected kind of an earlier notion within Israeli strategy that developed over a long time of creating kind of an autonomous structure, ultimately, you know, with a varying degree of sovereignty, but ultimately under their security and sovereign control. And I think that's what ultimately developed with the Palestinian Authority.
And the Israeli right, as you said, they're more ideologue, and the manifestation of that, the way I see it, is twofold. One is the removal of any checks on Israeli policy toward the Palestinians. And, you know, the Justice Minister, Ayelet Shaked's plans for that are to basically defang the Supreme Court, which is the only remaining sort of recourse against Israeli policy in the West Bank, at least for smaller scale issues. And the second is, you know, we refer to it as creeping annexation. And the right right now, the ideological right, the Netanyahu camp versus the Gantz camp, they're talking about more bold steps toward annexation. From a Palestinian perspective, does that mean anything? You know, we're already seeing this creeping annexation. Does it matter if there's a declaration or a name attached to it?
I think it does. I mean, personally, I think the establishment of an independent Palestinian state is almost a foregone conclusion at this point. I'm in that camp. But I think average Palestinians still cling...
Meaning it's not happening.
I think average Palestinians still cling to the notion of the establishment of a Palestinian state, of independence from Israel to some degree. And you know, if you have large-scale annexation, it eliminates that, and everybody knows that. Creeping annexation... You know, maybe you can finagle your way into something. But nobody really, although they cling to the notion, very few people think it's a possibility today. But when it comes to the leadership, nobody's producing any kind of vision of the future. I mean, that's happening outside or it's happening in civil society to some degree. But the political leadership is not producing any vision of the state. That's an alternative to that. And so average people, you know, aren't developing those ideas on their own necessarily and aren't galvanized by separate ideas of, alternative to solutions or even a binational state or anything like that. So I don't think we've gotten to that point yet. But I think it does make a difference between whether a large-scale annexation attempt is made or you know, this kind of creeping annexation policy continues and maybe there's annexation of the settlement blocks and various other things. But, I mean... I think Palestinians, to some extent, feel powerless in the face of the annexation policy, as well as the now, for the first time, and I think this is, like, to me, one of the most interesting dynamics. Maybe it's kind of an American bias that I have, but the emergence in the United States of a government. There's always been a pro-Israeli government, so obviously in the White House and in Washington, but the emergence of a unique perspective from within the White House that is. Kind of sees eye to eye ideologically with the far right in Israel and the settler movement. And I think, we kind of know the relationship between Jared Kushner and David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador, to the Israeli right and to the settler movement. And they've both contributed financially. And, you know, I've gone back just in my work and read, you know, he used to have a column, David Friedman had a column in, an Israeli settler newspaper. And you can go back and read his columns and what he thought. Up until the point, the eve of when he took office as American ambassador, and he's calling for the end of the two-state narrative, which he called like an anachronism, and basically said that Palestinian, the middle class, doesn't care if their leader is Benjamin Netanyahu or Mahmoud Abbas; it makes no difference to them. And so it's this kind of perception that get rid of the Palestinian Authority; it's all our country, it's all our state, and they'll be fine and. Everybody will be calm and be cool with Israeli sovereignty over all of the land under the condition that they don't have full political rights. And I think that's kind of a delusion. Can you pressure Palestinians enough? And this pressure is happening, obviously. Can you pressure Palestinians enough to kind of accommodate themselves to, state minus? Maybe in the immediate period. But
it's kind of the situation we have today.
Yes, exactly. I mean, my Palestinian uncle said to me yesterday, the one state. I mean, he's still a firm believer in two states, but he said, the one state is what we already have. Like when I was describing, the system that might come into existence, he said, yes, that's what we have already today. And I said, yes, that's absolutely right. There is a one state condition today. But, Palestinian nationalism is so strong and identity is so strong. People aren't just going to give up on their rights. They might, out of expediency, economic expediency, give up on something in the immediate term, but that never works in the long term. It's not like Palestinians are just going to relinquish their political rights and be willing to live under the hegemony of, a Jewish sovereign forever without political rights. I mean, that is crazy talk. But I think, the ideological right sees their end goal and that's all they see. And they kind of bend the current reality to fit that framework in their mind. And you know, because the pragmatists ask themselves, they say, oh, you know, what do you envision? Don't you see that we're heading towards apartheid here? And they, you know, if you go read, you know, some of the work from people in Naftali Bennett's party, it's like, you know, this is our version of democracy. Like, democracy doesn't have, I mean, of course, democracy is fluid a little bit, but this is our version of democracy. And people without political rights, oh, it's okay because, you know, it's still democracy. Like, that's not apartheid. But, you know, like, apartheid has no definition or you know, it's not a reality, or these people are going to accept that in the long term. Nobody in the 21st century is going to accept to live under those conditions long term.
And yet the Israeli right seem to be the only ones with any sort of vision that's not stuck in the expired Oslo process.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's difficult. It's hard to envision an alternative future and push for it. I mean, Israel, for all its flaws, you know, has a democratic system in place.
For Israelis.
For Israeli Jews, and, you know, to some extent for Palestinian Arabs. But nobody in a democracy makes difficult decisions when easy decisions are in front of them. You don't take political costs, especially in a system, a parliamentary system like Israel, in which the government can collapse overnight. And I think only one government in Israeli history has ever gone full term or something like that. It doesn't make sense. You need pressure or like a political cost in order to change your political calculation. And Israel doesn't have that. And so especially with the United States encouraging them and sheltering them and all that kind of stuff from political costs, they're just moving in the direction, the kind of almost inertia of the underlying Zionist impetus, which is to kind of continue settling the land, to take control of Eretz Israel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of, you know, forming a new calculation in which you kind of preserve the state you've succeeded in creating and avoiding this kind of confrontation with the one state reality that we're moving towards.
Right. I think what we don't often say is that the status quo is not a static situation. The status quo is a dynamic process moving in a certain direction.
Dynamic quo or something to that degree. Yeah, I mean, of course, every day Palestinians live the reality that it's not static. More land confiscation, more settlements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, a constant loss and expropriation of Palestinian livelihood. And so, yes, of course, for them, it's not static at all.
We've touched on this question in a few places. But can you call it a democracy if half of the people who live under Israeli rule can't vote in that democracy?
No, I don't think you can. It's a bit difficult of a question, but no, I mean, Israeli democracy is severely flawed. Does it have democratic institutions? Sure. Does it serve its full public? No. I mean, when you had democracy in 1776 in the United States, you had a significant population, slave population that had no rights, or
and
women that couldn't vote, or, you know, a million other things. So, no, it wasn't a democracy or full democracy in that sense. And even within what we conceive of Israeli citizenry and voting, there's not full rights. I mean, Palestinian citizens of Israel have a hollow citizenship. Although they vote and participate in elections, their ability to influence policy is severely restricted. And, you know, we can look, and we'll come back to the elections on this, you know, no Palestinian party, and despite having, you know, being the third largest party in the Israeli Knesset this time around, or the last time around, and being 20% of the population, has never been included in a governing coalition. And that, you know, they've always been in the opposition, never really being able to influence policy. But even outside of that, you know, I was reading a study by Med El Carmel, which is a research institute based in Haifa, and they looked at the 16th Knesset and between 2000 and 2005, and showed that all bills proposed by Arab MKs, only 2% passed into law. And these were all bills that were, you know, kind of for the general welfare of the public, not challenging the kind of the system of governance at all. And only 2%. So even within, you know, talked about the kind of cynicism that's in Palestinian society in the West Bank and Gaza Strip towards elections, even within Palestinian society, within what we call 48 or the inside or Palestinian citizens of Israel, there is a kind of a frustration with the ability to affect and change and create a society that's a state for all its citizens, and create an Israeli sense of identity that's inclusive of them. All these efforts from within have failed. And in fact, that kind of assertion by the Palestinian public within Israel of their rights and of their sense of identity and all of this kind of stuff has created a serious blowback by an increasingly right-wing government within Israel that has looked to circumscribe those rights and limit them. And this was, you know, in greatest effect and appearance in the passage of the nation state law last year, in which, you know, pretty firmly we have in the basic law that Israel is a nation state of the Jewish people and self-determination belongs to them alone. And that's in the land of Israel, not just within the borders of Israel. So if we see annexation, we're going to see that applied to the entire land. And that means no self-determination for Palestinians anywhere or non-Jews. And that, you know, is really the definition of apartheid, right? And the lack of democracy. And so I think this effort by the Palestinian citizens of Israel to push for their rights is actually exposing the illusion of democracy within Israel. And this kind of framework in which Israel bases itself as Jewish and democratic, which is a real, to borrow a term, the cardinal contradiction within Israeli society, is being exposed because you can't, as long as you have non-Jewish citizenry, you can't be Jewish and democratic. And so that contradiction there, I think, is being exposed for the first time. And that's part of also the movement away from two states. I mean, people are kind of waking up to different realities.
Thank you, Omar.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I'm Michael Schaefer Omerman. This episode was produced by myself and Henriette Schakar. If you like what you just listened to, please hit subscribe. And if you leave us a review on iTunes, it'll really help other people find us.